Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Sarah Carradine, podcasting from unceded Gadigal land.
I'm Mari Forth.
And this is Crime Scene, the true crime review podcast where we get to the heart of how true crime stories are told.
Subscribe to our feed, robhasawebsite.com/crimefeed, to get your true crime on Tuesdays. We also drop on the main feed on Wednesdays.
And Mari, there's another great reason to subscribe. We're dropping bonus content into the crime feed only. Inside Job brings you conversations with people who know crime, the law, and justice from the inside. Our first episode, The Criminal, is in the crime feed right now.
Before we get to today's property, we can have an update on a previous case that we discussed. This was a good one. This was a fun one. It was the dropout episode. We have an update. Sonny Balwani, the partner of Elizabeth Holmes of Theranos fame, was convicted of 12 charges of fraud in federal courts earlier this month. And if you remember, Holmes was convicted of only 4 counts. So you can go and hear our coverage of the case. We talked about a little bit about the documentary The Inventor, the Hulu series The Dropout, and it's on our episode 6 of Crime Scene if you haven't already checked that out. So Sarah, what are we talking about today?
Well, we've had lots of requests for this one, including from Heather and Joelle. So thanks, everyone. We do appreciate your suggestions. And as you can see, we listen to them. So let's open today's file. We watched Girl in the Picture on Netflix. It was directed by Skye Borgman, and we've seen her previous films, Dead Asleep and Abducted in Plain Sight among them. So we were anticipating something quite good. Joining us, who better than a person who's been with us right from the start? She brought us Shot Doctor in episode 3, and she's back to help us untangle this dark cat's cradle. Debate coach and podcast host, the antisocial extrovert, LaTonya Starks. Welcome, LaTonya.
Hi. It's so good to be back with you two. I'm very excited to talk about this today.
So, to the crime, there are going to be serious spoilers now. So, if you're intending to watch the documentary first, you need to hop off and join us again afterwards.
And I just want to add, like, seriously, you do probably not want to be spoiled on this. I would say, just upfront going into this documentary, it's best to go in blind for me. So a little hint at my recommendations there.
This thing has more twists and turns than the Autobahn. You all are going to want to go and watch it before you listen to this podcast.
Okay. And I third that recommendation. So if you've already watched, or if you're just being defiant and you want to listen to us before watching it, strap in. Franklin Floyd kidnapped Suzanne Marie Savakis when she was 4 years old and raised her as his own daughter while sexually abusing her. He led them on a life of moving around with many aliases as he was on the run from law enforcement. Suzanne, sometimes called Sharon or Tonya, was made by Floyd to work in strip clubs and at sex parties when she was a teenager. She had a child when she was 18 named Michael, though Floyd was not Michael's father. Floyd married her and moved them on yet again. He kept control of Suzanne by never leaving her alone with Michael. In 1990, when Suzanne was 20, Floyd killed her in a hit and run. Michael was fostered by a loving family who were preparing to adopt him 4 years later when Floyd abducted and killed Michael. Floyd was finally arrested, but he couldn't be charged with Michael's murder as his body has never been found. But he was convicted of kidnapping Michael and was serving a 52-year sentence when he was linked to the murder of Cheryl Ann Comesso, one of Suzanne's friends from the strip club, who had disappeared in 1989. After her body was discovered in 1995 and Floyd was convicted of her murder, he was given a death sentence. In 2014, he finally gave the FBI Suzanne's real name, and in 2015, he finally admitted to killing Michael. Floyd remains on death row and is now 79. And if you've seen the documentary, you will know that that is a quarter of what was going on with this terrible, terrible man.
Yeah. Yeah. It is one of those documentaries where it's definitely a trigger warning for like sexual assault, child sexual abuse, murder, kidnapping, child murder. It is like it
sexual
runs,
assault.
Yeah.
It,
like
all of it.
It piles up. It truly piles up. So fair warning to our listeners. No graphic. There's no real graphic images or anything like that. So that's one thing you don't have to worry about. But definitely just giving everybody a heads up.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to start, first of all, before we dig into details of the documentary and details of the crime, because I know we all have a lot to say. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to talk first in general about the layout of the documentary. I've given the crime in its chronological order, but it's certainly not how we hear about it in the documentary. Latonya, mm-hmm. what did you think about how the film jumped around in time? Did you always feel that you knew where you were situated? How effective did you think that was?
So typically when there are going to be places where they jump through time, there is, I think, a much more successful way to do the title card to allow people to fully understand. First of all, to not just flash it for 2 seconds, because I found that was really not enough time to get reacclimated to the state of mind that I needed to be in. Because I found myself in different states of mind throughout different parts of the documentary. And it was like, how angry am I going to be about this thing now? How outraged am I going to be about this? I need a little bit more warning. And I think that having a title card that comes up that it holds for more than 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. Same is true of the names, by the way. I had to pause a ton to get mm-hmm. the names of people. And people's names in this, very important. So if yes. I had any criticisms of this documentary, I would say it needs to be run back through and taken up a level or so in terms of watchability, because there are just some things that you need to be able to navigate. They go back and forth through time, but using the same players and mm-hmm. using people who have multiple aliases. So you need to know. Basically, the way that they did the timeline is what they were calling this woman, this who is the victim that we talk about here, Suzanne, throughout the documentary. But we're jumping back and randomly in time. We go like from 2006 to 1973. It's like, what happened in 1973? When did we get there? Yeah. So, yeah, I would say that and then like keeping the names on screen for a longer amount of time, or even having a timeline itself. I've seen documentaries that have edited themselves in chronological order, not in chronological order, but because they have a running timeline at the bottom, those visuals really give something to people who are trying to discern what's happening in a very difficult to follow story.
I completely agree with that. There was a few times where me and James were watching and I was like, wait, what time period is this? It truly felt like I was confused as to where we were in time. And the reason why, like, we really harped on that, like, oh, you should go watch it first type of thing. Like, I think it's a good documentary, but I think it's not as enjoyable once you know the outcome. Like, on this is one of those rare things that on the second watch, I actually liked it less on the second watch. And I was like, oh, wow. and not because of what was shown, but more because once you know the outcome, when they start to jump back and forth, it becomes annoying, actually, at least in my take. What did you think, Sarah?
Well, I like the order. I do like the order of how they told it, because I felt that it was as if we were the detective, even though there are a different number of law enforcement and a different people finding out things. So we were given it in the order that things were found out, starting with the discovery of Suzanne's body in 1990. So I think the order that they told it was really good, but I absolutely agree they needed to do much more work to locate us and take us with them. And a simple thing, as you say, like a timeline along the bottom, or just her name at the time somewhere. The graphics were very arty, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it took away from our ability, I think, sometimes to locate ourselves in time.
Yes. I think something where we could have definitely been able, like a time marker, because specifically, there are some specific moments. So after watching when you watch the documentary, you're like, okay, there are time points that stick out to you. Once you rewatch the documentary and you're like, hey, we're at this time period, why didn't they just fully tell us everything that happened at this time period? Instead, they went to this time period, they jumped forward to this time period, they jumped all the way backwards to the first time period, and then they come back to that middle time period to add on to it. And it's just like, I feel like you didn't have to break it up like that. And there's a few sections I was like, I feel like they did not have to break this up like that.
Yeah. The discovery that that they had lived as a father and daughter, and this is what many people knew them as, father and daughter. They wanted to hold on, the filmmakers wanted to hold on to the surprise that she wasn't his daughter for so long that when we got to the explanation of him being in jail at the time when she would have been born, it's a surprise, nicely done, but I felt it was placed so much later because the filmmaker wanted to hold on to the surprise. Whereas I think they could have given us that information earlier. We could have lived the horror, you know, otherwise you sort of have the horror retroactively. So I felt sometimes, although I did say that I liked the order that they told things, there were some things that you got the shockwaves of horror continually coming. Mm-hmm. And they could have given us a little bit more, clump the horror a little bit more together, and then mm-hmm. give us some rest time in between. I also thought this was a good documentary, just to spoil my overall mm-hmm. rating. I will be giving it a high rating, but that was one thing I felt was sacrificed to the art of the film, was taking us with the narrative. So let's start at the beginning. Mari.
The way the documentary opens up, right? So it opens up and it's like, there's not many like reenactments here, which we of course appreciate, but it opens up where it was a talking head saying, like, on this day in 1990, three guys were on the road. They see debris, and then they find out that there is a woman on the side of the road. It looks like she's been in a hit and run. And so this is how we're introduced, how the story opens. And they find out the woman's name is Tanya Hughes. They rush her to the hospital. They're treating her for her injuries. At this point, she is still alive. Her husband, Clarence Hughes, then comes to the hospital to give more background on her. And then after a few days, she passes away. And it starts off like that, you know, and it sets the scene of like, okay, is this just it makes you think, okay, is this just going to be a regular true crime story, really, you know? And but then it immediately turns to like, you know, she was at the time Tanya Hughes. She was a stripper at Passions, I believe it was. And when her friends heard that she passed away, they tried calling her mom and her extended family to tell them what had happened. When they had called this woman who they thought was her mom, she's like, I don't know what you're talking about. My daughter died 20 years ago when she was 18 months. And then that's how the friends said, like, oh, this is when we realized, like, we don't know her name. And then that's when it really starts to pick up steam. So they open it with the mystery first. And, you know, after that, we get the Tanya Hughes segment about her being, a stripper, and we're introduced to Clarence. Her husband is what they perceive him to be. I mean, he's her husband. And then they talk about Michael, and I think I like this opening. I think this opening was very effective. And I think this opening is why a lot of people messaged us and said we should review this, because it kind of starts off one way and then it just takes so many twists and turns. And I do think that this was a decent starting point. LaTanya, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree that it hooked me again. No reenactments, wonderful, or silent ones that are very short. Love it. It hooked me right at the very beginning, because you get kind of the double whammy of, well, triple whammy of, this woman was 20 years old when she passed away. And it was tragic. And, you know, the nurses there said they suspected foul play. Then we get to find out that her name was not really her name. And then we find out that she has a son that we don't know what happened to. So very good kind of like three hit way to get people into the documentary at the very beginning. The other thing that I liked is that they rely heavily on the people who knew her best. And two of those people are dancers. And I just think that it's cool to hear from people in the sex work community, but to kind of get an idea of what, almost a slice of life. And it just seems normalized in this documentary, if that makes any sense. Like, it doesn't matter that we're at a strip club right now while we're filming this. We're just talking to a person and choosing to believe these women. So I enjoyed that part of the documentary as well, because the first kind of talking head that we get is this woman, Karen, and she, who was, as Mari said, a dancer at Passions with who she thought was Tanya. And that's where we get to learn a lot more about Tanya or Suzanne's relationship with her son, Michael, and just how much that child had gone through at the age of two. Was a lot, I think, but all very good ways to bring people into a documentary.
Yeah, I think Karen here and Heather, who was at Mons Venus, the most marvelously named strip club I've ever heard of. the community and the sorority, you would almost say, of these dancers was really strong, and I think that's a really good point. They also, this is where Cheryl, the woman who Floyd murdered, and finally he was charged with that many years later. They were talking about her. She had ambitions. She wanted to be a model. Suzanne, when she was younger, had wanted to go to Georgia Tech. So they were talking about this life as a life of, you know, smart women making their own choices and having ambitions. And the care that they had for each other, because Heather does talk about trying to help who she knew as Tanya, trying to help Cheryl, and they knew far more than a normal co-worker would know, because they see each other with in the dressing room. And to this day, both of those women are very affected by the deaths of both Suzanne and Cheryl.
Yeah, and it was Karen who went to DHS and got mm-hmm. Michael taken away. So that's a brave thing to do no matter what, because honestly, the last thing that you want to do for a child that you care about, especially, is to see them in the system. But to realize that they're in a situation that is so much worse for them, mm-hmm. and to get them out takes a lot of courage, because he could have come after her. I'm sure he suspected her as the person who did it. He could have just as easily did to her what he did to Cheryl later. I just think that it was really brave of her. And then we meet the two of the most sympathetic people in the whole documentary, the Beans.
So sad. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ernest and Merle. I mean, they're just perfection.
Yeah. And this is what I definitely call like Michael's section here, because like once Heather does that amazing thing, gets Michael out, Michael ends up with the Beans, and the Beans just describe how, you know, he was a very shy, like he was very different when he came to them, and it just took a few days and he opened up and he was amazing. And he was very lucky to be with them for 4 years. But the whole time he was with the Beans, what was he going by the name at this point? Clarence Hughes, the proposed dad, was trying to get Michael back the whole time. And then somebody finally was like, well, let's take a DNA test. And then they found out it wasn't like Michael wasn't his. And so they revoked all the rights. I think I wonder like how at first there was like supervised visits. If the child doesn't want to go on the supervised visits, why make them go? You know what I'm saying?
DHS, there was very little said about them, but what was said was all terrible. First of all, they said they give the Beans this 2-year-old child and say, only give him a bottle of milk and some Pepsi. Give this 2-year-old child Pepsi. That's what we've been doing. And it worked.
And I love Mel. She said, no, I gave him a cup of milk. He had a tantrum. And within a week, he was fine.
He was fine.
So weird, yo.
It's very weird. And then to have a child, everything is supposed to be in the best interest of the children. Mm-hmm. So to have a child coming out, as Mari said, of those sessions and hiding, you know, all the Beans would have to say is he hides under furniture and says that mean man. And then you would at least get supervised visits where someone, you know, who is a professional could observe. It's the beginning. Maybe the beginning of the story is the beginning, but it's the very beginning instance in this documentary of an ongoing, and I'll continue to notice it, to point it out, institutional failure from top to bottom. That happened in several institutions.
Right. And here is like Michael, they did the right thing, because once they found out that he was not actually his father, they revoked his parenting. But unfortunately, Clarence ends up kidnapping Michael. And he kidnapped the principal and Michael.
And like, the principal didn't try to stop that child. I'm sorry. I'm going to be judgmental about this. But if I get kidnapped, of course I want to survive, but I'm not going to let you take a 2-year-old baby that I know doesn't belong to you and you're kidnapping at gunpoint. At that point, whatever is going to happen is going to happen. And then maybe hopefully I'll get to heaven. Who knows? But I can't see being a school principal and saying, whatever it takes to save my life, take me to a tree. But take the two-year-old.
Exactly.
This is James David. We don't have any contemporary interview with him, but he was interviewed at the time, and he was outraged at being tied to a tree. I thought you should be much more outraged that this man has a child that doesn't belong to him.
Right. Yes. And I think the reason why we're like harping on this is the first time where we get the time jump. And this is one of the times where I'm kind of like, it wasn't as egregious as some parts later in the series. So let me talk about how this part I liked and maybe a part I didn't like. So from the principal getting taped up to the tree and Clarence running off with Michael, they did everything they did. They put out the bolo. They were looking. They brought in the FBI. Sarah, what's the name of the FBI guy that we got?
John Fitzpatrick.
Yeah, he was amazing. And he was, he said, like, all of the facts that we know as true crime professionals, like, or podcasters, you gotta, if you get the child, don't get the child within the 2 days, your chances really plummet after that. And then he even says, like, they talked to a profiler, and a profiler said, like, you have maybe a week tops, because after a week, Michael will be an inconvenience to Clarence, and he will more than likely kill him. And it, this part was really sad, because it was all over the news and went national. Like, they're looking for, he was on the FBI's most wanted list. They had his aliases, all the different aliases, and they were looking for him. And this is where the childhood friend, Sherry, what was Sherry's last name here?
Sherry Fostenberry.
Yes, Sherry. Oh, shoot. No, was it Sherry? No, I'm sorry. It was Jenny Fisher.
It was Jenny Fisher. Yeah.
I apologize. It was Jenny Fisher, who was the one who saw, she was being called Tanya Hughes on the news. And she said, Mom, they're calling this lady Tanya, but her name is actually Sharon, right? Or Susan.
What did you know her? Sharon.
Okay, guys, there were so many aliases.
Yeah, let's take a quick second to get all of the aliases out there so that you know we're talking about either Floyd, who is the person who perpetrated all of this, or Suzanne, who was his victim for her entire life. So Suzanne's aliases are Sharon Marshall, which she primarily goes by when she's young and living in, I believe, Georgia with her quote-unquote father, and she is in high school. So when you hear Jenny talk about her, you'll hear Jenny say Sharon. Then we have Tanya Tadlock. Tadlock isn't really used, but Tanya Hughes is. So the name Tanya is what she danced under. As for Floyd's aliases, we have Trenton Davis, Warren Marshall, Clarence Hughes, and Brandon Cleo Williams. So he was Clarence Hughes, I believe, from the time that Sharon was in high school to when Sharon became Tanya. And then he was Brandon Cleo Williams when he first kind of came into the story of Tanya's life at all and met her mother.
Yeah. And the thing is, she was Tanya Tadlock so briefly because he changed their names and then married her, and
married
she
her,
became
right.
She became mm-hmm.
when they were on the run.
Yes,
yeah, and I just want to and thank you. I just want to point it out. This was the one transition that I thought it was the first one. I was like, this made a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. So when Jenny saw her on the news, they reached out to the FBI and they're like, "Hey, you're calling this girl Tanya, but I knew her as Sharon Marshall." And when we hear that, we then go, we get a glimpse of Sharon in high school. And this is a very good part. If there's any part that I think really highlights the victim here so that we don't forget Suzanne is the victim here, this was the part. This was such a great part. It talks about her being in high school, talks about her being an overachiever and graduating and all of that. And I like this part. And I thought this part was good here, but I did not like the transition after this. Or I didn't like some transitions after this. Sarah, how did you feel about some of the jumping around parts? And were there any parts in particular? Because we can jump around here too. Yeah, we're not going to go in order like we said. Mm-hmm. But where were the parts that you thought were egregious? Or is that just me and LaTanya? Did you enjoy the twists and turns?
I mean, I do think that the order that they told it in was good and valid, and it's as if you're discovering along with them. What my critique is that they don't give us time or enough of an indication of when we are or where we are.
Okay.
So some either stronger narration or, I mean, we're so visually literate now, 2022. Give it to us on the screen. Give us a date. Give us a time. I've seen there's a wonderful series at the moment, mockumentary called Players, which is about gamers. And they just simply have a block that runs backwards and forwards over a timeline of dates. Mm-hmm. Very, very simple. I'm not saying that that's what they should have done, but there are simple ways to do it. So I think the order that the story, to be clear, the order the story is told in, I think, is good. But our situation in time as we watch it could have been stronger. I agree with you about this high school So we've gone from this this woman who's died, the mystery about her name. Ah, no, she's Sharon. Okay, so now we know who she is. She's Sharon, as far as we understand it. We hear from her classmates who thought she was wonderful, are still very affected by her death. And then later we do hear of the home life from her friend Jenny Fisher, who goes to a sleepover, finds that the house has no doors. The house has only sheets hung up in the doorway. Mm-hmm. And
red flag.
Yeah.
A red flag. And her friend Sharon's apparent father walks in on them as they're changing, carrying a gun, mind you, and comes back later and tells Jenny to put a pillow over her face, and she hears him raping her friend, who comforts her. Sharon comforted her after the rape, and it's very hard to listen to, and you can see that she is affected to this day, as why wouldn't she be? I found this section, when they came to it, they put that in later, very difficult to watch, but told in the, I thought it was told in a very, like it was told in a very simple way. And what did you think, Latanya, about this high school section?
I thought it was really effective in several things. As Mari said, highlighting the victim here and just giving us a dose of what we'll get for the rest of the documentary to kind of tell us exactly what it must have been like to live her life. You know, it just seemed horrifying. I was never allowed to go to sleepovers when I was in school. My grandmother did not allow it. And then I hear story like all of these sleepover stories, and I understand why as an adult, but I didn't when I was a kid. The fact that this Jenny's mother was so hesitant to let her, you know, go and said, "Don't tell your father," because the first time Floyd ever met Jenny, her parents, he asked Jenny's dad for money, which is just really out of characteristic behavior for someone who isn't just like antisocial. I thought this segment was really powerful, where Jenny starts to talk about, to recount the incident that she's been grappling with since she was 15 years old. You know, this is something that clearly she still sees in her head. And to just think of coming into a house with no doors when you have, you know, young people in the house, privacy is so important. Privacy just in general for anyone is so important, but especially when you have young, like developing people in the house, privacy is very important. And the idea that there's no doors anywhere, major red flag, as Mari said. And then this woman, Jenny, has to lay there and in fear for her life and her best friend's life as well, and listen to her friend be raped at gunpoint.
Yeah.
It's just wild.
It is wild. And I will say that part was very like poignant in all the things you said, both of you guys said, but I thought it was misplaced. I really was like, we're presenting it as if it was with that high school stuff. It was not.
And it that's was not, what you're right.
It really, that when I on the rewatch, that really kind of frustrated me, because when we get the high school segment, we get the friends, it was so nice. And then it's capped with Jenny Fisher talking to the police. And the police are like, "Oh, you know, this is his wife." And Jenny's just sitting there like, "No, that's her father. That's her father. I don't know what you guys are talking about." And then the police officer, "No, sweetie, this is his wife. They were married." And Jenny's just sitting there, like, she tells us to camera shock, like, they had a completely different picture of Sharon than I did, you know? And then we go on a tangent about, like, the police officer is like, okay, so we knew that's not her name, and she had an alias. So we checked Floyd's background, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm just kind of explaining this in a sense that makes sense. But like, we go off on the different tangent. Like we're introduced to Tanya. We're introduced to her leaving, saying she's going to go have the baby in Arizona. She can't go to Georgia Tech because she got pregnant. And we get Tanya and we get this whole story. But by the time they come back and then we go to the rape with Jenny and we talk about the rape with Jenny, it felt out of place. And then not only did it feel out of place, is like, did you make Jenny act when she was talking to the police officer in that situation where she was like, I was so shocked. Like, you know, why would Clarence marry his daughter? But then, boom, later on, we get the rape scene and she's talking about how it affected her whole life. A little bit later, boom, she's at trial and she's like, he was a monster and I couldn't wait to put him behind bars. And I'm just kind of like, I don't like that narrative storytelling in a documentary. Like, if this main person is a witness and she's talking to us straight at the camera, I don't know if I like that they're telling her, okay, well, put yourself in this mindset when you were in high school and tell us this section. Okay, and now this section, and now this section. Does that make sense? Am I rambling here?
No. I totally get what you're saying. I think that the interview was probably conducted in a completely different way than how it was presented to us temporally in the documentary. So okay. I think that this was probably an interview that was done with Jenny where they tried to stay within the confines of some type of time, like linear timeline. But then they took parts for their own narrative storytelling purposes. They just distributed the parts of her interview in different places.
And I agree.
It does seem to, now that you're saying it, because I do agree, it was a lot more tedious to watch this documentary on the second watch. Part of that could just be because we're podcasters. And so we are like at that point, not enjoying what we're watching anymore. We're just taking notes and paying as much attention as we can. But, you know, it was more tedious to watch on a second watch for me because of things like this, because it would be great if we got these women and what they have to say about Sharon or Tanya, but grouped in a way that makes sense on some type of timeline. And if you are going to jump around, then make sure you have a more important end goal than setting up this kind of revenge narrative for a woman that we can't even know if that was her true motivation for, you know, like testifying against Floyd ultimately. But that's what it looks like in the way that they've edited it.
I think the story of her testifying at the trial is in the right place because it's when he's been arrested and her testimony is really important. But I agree with you. I think the story of the rape and her witnessing it and the effect it had on her belonged back in the high school section. And I'm just going to pause here and say, you know, yet again, we see the ripples out from crime. She herself was not raped, but it's a double thing of witnessing it, fearing for her life, wondering if she would be as well. It's actually still sexual assault on Jenny.
It's still sexual assault.
Yeah.
And she never told anyone. Mm-hmm. And to carry that with you, to be put into that position by anyone to not speak, you know, Heather and Karen, our dancers, also have regrets about could I have stopped it. So the ripples out of the hideous crimes of this man, but the fact of how people are affected. Which is why to hear that someone like Karen did speak out about Michael and went to the DHS is really fantastic. So do speak out, everybody. Don't keep quiet out of fear. I mean, obviously, be safe and save your own life. But to speak out is almost never the wrong thing.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They're also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus. Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. I think that wasn't the only time jump that I did not really like. When we get into, sorry, all of the names, is it Cheryl's murder?
Yes.
Yes.
Cheryl's murder. So again, we get that section after high school about Tanya, her when she first becomes like a stripper down in Florida, when they're in Florida, Tampa Bay, Florida. And where she meets, again, I'm like, dang it. Every time I need it, my list of names is not there. Heather, when we're introduced to Heather at Mons Venus talking about Tanya and her first, like what we understand is Tanya's first experience being in a strip club and then being forced to, work as a sex worker, by, at this point, Clarence. Now we get a glimpse of Cheryl. They tell us about Cheryl and how Cheryl was a dancer there and all of that. And then it just kind of like this section just ends with them leaving Tampa Bay. And then we come back like a little bit later. Like again, it like the jumping around, it works the first time. It truly does. But it just seems like the second time it doesn't. The only thing that I really liked from this section here, because they couldn't reveal to us Cheryl's murder at first, because that's what this is. This section is kind of like, it's trying to introduce the concept of Cheryl, but it's not, they don't want to reveal that she has been murdered and that he murdered her until later. It kind of feels like a little bit of filler because, I mean, I guess the most we learn from this section is that like Clarence is still a dick. He's, you know, making her perform sex work. We do meet the babysitter, yeah, Michelle. I loved her. Yes. Yeah. She was so animated. She was Michael's babysitter and all of that. And it was just like this section without Cheryl's murder really kind of was just like, eh. To me, you know, Michelle is the one who accidentally sees Clarence puts in a tape to record wrestling.
Yeah.
And
glad you got that plug.
Yeah, the VHS tape to record some wrestling, but on that VHS tape is Cheryl and Tanya like
topless, dancing around.
Yeah, and at this point, they still think that she's his daughter. They think she's his daughter. So it was very weird. That gets around. Cheryl disappears and then they leave. So am I alone in this?
Did
you think this section was necessary?
I think it was necessary. I just think the placement is wrong. It would have been so much easier to stay with Jenny in 1994 because we get this tiny section and then we get the section about the sleepover. And it seems like an interruption, I think, because it doesn't make sense where it is.
Yeah. For me, what works with Michelle is we meet Michelle. She's the babysitter. She loved Michael. She used to see Cheryl, and it's her admiration of Cheryl, this beautiful, cool girl who would wave to her. And she was a young tween girl with getting attention from this, you know, this glamorous, beautiful woman who had her own car and just seemed very cool. So we get all that. And I think then when she returns to the narrative, when she identifies from a photograph, with Cheryl's body on the bed, when she identifies the bed as the bed in the trailer that Clarence and Tonya were living in and Michael, I thought that was an example of using the time really well. So we meet Michelle, we love Michelle, and then later she has a material piece of evidence mm-hmm. when it's time to give it. So there were times when the jumps absolutely worked. For me, what – I mean, I got a real idea of – Cheryl, she wanted to be in Playboy. She wanted to be a model. And that was one of the ways that Clarence said he would film her in order to send it off as an audition to Playboy, which, of course, he didn't do. The argument that Heather sees between the two should have been in this section, Clarence in his car arguing with Cheryl and then trying to run over Heather, that should have all been in this section. Then some narration where Tonya and Clarence left, and also we never saw Cheryl again. Mm-hmm. So just give us that, place it in time so that when we come back to this extraordinary coming together of two separate jurisdictions to discover that a Jane Doe that one jurisdiction has is Cheryl, putting a name to the remains that they find and being able to charge this awful man and give him the death penalty, that was all told well, but tell me that at the time that they left, Cheryl also disappeared. You just have to drop it in and leave it there.
Yeah, I thought I missed that. I was like, I did not realize until they came back that she was, you know, that she was dead. Yeah. Like, I did not know that. I didn't know that she had disappeared. So yeah, it was a turn in the bend there that I was just like really, really kind of confused about. And I agree. Like, I feel like they could have gone in the sense of like a mounting continuous terror type thing, as opposed to like a jumpy narrative. Because if you think about it, if you push Jenny's section right up against the high school portion, because then after she witnesses that rape, they do eventually leave. Then you put the Tonya section, like the Tonya, Cheryl, Heather section, including the beating there, that could have been good. That could have like led it to like, oh, every time they're about to leave, they have to be on the run because something happens type of narrative, as opposed to a little bit of a jumping around here. But I mean, I don't know if we're getting too into the weeds at the beginning, because this is again still not even everything that happened. So what would you like to talk about next, Sarah? Like, because, I mean, it just was like so many twists and turns here.
Can I just say something really quickly before we move on to the next topic? I think that we can kind of sum up the frustrations that we've been venting so far about how this documentary was presented to us and whether or not it was the most effective way, by acknowledging that this is a documentary that privileged style over substance at points. And I have an issue with that. Just generally, when it comes to entertainment, I'd rather have substance than have something that's overly stylized. It is a very inventive kind of way to think of it, to have the timeline go back and forth, have us go back and forth in the timeline so much so that we can be like the detectives figuring it out. But you are sacrificing actually building in more drama by doing that. And I think that this is one of the issues I have with this documentary is the privileging form and style over actual substance and actual mystery building, but by trying to be a mystery box of a documentary.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And this is why I always loved it when Joe Fitzpatrick, the retired FBI agent, who is, of course, interviewed in a diner, whenever he was on the screen, I felt like I'd landed, because I felt that he was going to give me the straight information and he could really locate us. And he had a way of telling a story that it was very interesting for this law enforcement man. He was thinking of the story, and it must be said, he's been carrying it with him for his career and, in fact, retired. He said the two things that he'd never closed were who was Tonya, as he knew her, and where was Michael. And the fact that in his retirement, he came out of retirement to assist the forensic case manager, Ashley Rodriguez, who we meet later, who is with the Missing and Exploited Children organization, and he was able to come out of retirement and assist her and, in fact, close the case. So I think you're right, Latonya, because that when we see Joe, it's really straightforward. It's a man sitting in a booth in a diner giving us the information and in a case that he's really invested in. Should we go on to – oh, sorry, Mari.
No. I was just saying. I agree. I could have probably sat there and just listened to the FBI guy.
Yeah.
Honestly, I've never been so excited to see a
cop.
Yeah. Particularly compared to the twin FBI agents we see later in their blue shirts.
Oh my God, the twins.
They love each other so much. They love each other. Oh, and then he said this. Oh yes, but it was so great because he said this. I mean, they did get the information of who Suzanne was, and they did get him to confess to the murder of Michael in a very clever but awful way of saying, oh, Michael was your new Suzanne. Latonya, do you want to talk about motherhood and its portrayal throughout this documentary?
I would like to talk about that. So something that I saw come up in this documentary, especially as we head toward the end section, because, of course, we don't get a clear picture of exactly the magnitude of this man's ridicularity until near the end of the documentary. But there are a couple of running feeds that are going. There's very much a hysterical woman kind of thing that shows up a couple times. Once when Mrs. Bean called the cops because she saw Floyd drive by in his van. When he found out that he could no longer have visitation rights, and the cops were like, you're just being paranoid. From what we hear Sandra, Suzanne's biological mother, say, when she went to get help either at DHS or with the cops, they just told her, oh, this is a civil issue. You're married. You're going to have to figure it out. And that led to it just kind of happened in the background. It wasn't something that I think was intentional, but there was the good mother, bad mother dichotomy that was kind of presented. So if people in the documentary want the audience to think of, it seems, to think of Suzanne's biological mother as a bad mother because she didn't do everything possible she lost her kids in the first place. She lost her three kids to the system. And then when she got them back, because he kidnapped all three of her kids.
Yeah.
He just dropped her two twins off at a charity
orphanage.
And he took Suzanne. And when she got her other two kids back, there was a question of whether or not she did enough to try to find her daughter. She says that when she went to the police, they said it was a civil matter because she was married to Floyd at the time. I don't know why that means that he gets to take a child that is not biologically his.
Right.
And adopted that child.
That's another
institutional failure here that is just like, this wouldn't be a recent law because he was convicted of pedophilia back in the 60s. You can't just take a kid, even if you live in the house with them, if you're not their biological father. Your marriage to the mother of that child doesn't mean anything legally. You've just taken a child. You dropped two of them off at the orphanage, and then you kept going with the other one. And she's a bad mother because she only went to the cops once, I guess.
Yeah, and he wasn't the father of any of those children.
None.
And I thought it was very interesting that they made it so that they told about the biological mother and the biological father. They were together. The father went off to Vietnam. It was Vietnam, right?
Yeah, it was Vietnam.
And by the time he came back, they were like, oh yeah, she had moved on. And she they very much were like, oh, she definitely cheated on him while he was in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. She had two other kids by the whatever the man it was that I think she got married to after the original father. And then he was out of the picture too. We don't know where he went. So she was found like crying in a church, and that's where Floyd found her. And it's just like, I mean, I think it's heartbreaking. I think it's more, I think it's much more heartbreaking than all of her, her fault. You know what I'm saying? Like, right. That I feel like she's taken advantage of. Like, she was a woman who was alone with three kids who was taken advantage of by a pedophile. And I think she just didn't know what was coming until it had already happened.
Right.
I don't know if I want to fully blame her.
Sarah? This is this fact that people say, oh, why do step parents, generally stepfathers, become pedophiles? It's actually the other way around. Pedophiles seek to become step parents, stepfathers, yeah. Mm-hmm. To gain access to children. When he met Sandra, Suzanne's biological mother, mm-hmm. her children were in the system. She was crying in a church. He says, darling, I'm here for you. What's the problem? Let me solve it. She tells him, and he says, well, I'll solve it. Let's get married. And she was in a desperate state. Mm-hmm. And I think to judge, here we have a surprising piece of information from Heather, the dancer at Mons Venus, where she says, well, I was taken for nearly 5 years and my mother.
Oh, right.
Like, where did this come from?
You were taken? That was one of the biggest twists that I was not expecting in this documentary. When she said, I was taken, it is so matter of fact, just like, I was taken when I was for 5 years, 1970. I was like, you were what and what for what?
I know. And even the documentary moved on, was like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, her, just another Tuesday.
Her point was that my mother, you know, moved heaven and earth to find me.
Mm-hmm.
And this shade on poor
Sandra
who looks like she's had, we meet Sandra today. She's not at the rededication of the tombstone. So when Suzanne died and she was known as Tonya and they realized she wasn't, they gave her a very simple tombstone that just said Tonya and no dates or anything like that. So at the end of the documentary, we see the rededication. We now have her name. We have her dates. There's a photograph of her.
Pretty photo. And
beautiful.
Yeah, really pretty. And present are her biological father, Cliff, and her daughter, Megan, who she gave up for adoption. So yeah. Megan was her third child. Again, sorry about complication. She had one child at high school who was a boy who was put out for adoption. She had
Michael. Didn't get anything
we
about
him. We did nothing about him.
About the first child.
Presumably we haven't found him. We have Michael, and we know what happened to Michael. She kept him. And then when she was pregnant again, she was not allowed to keep this one. And she... It sounded like a privately arranged adoption because Megan's adoptive mother met the woman that we now know as Suzanne, and she says she offered to help her to get away from Clarence.
No, she just wanted to know, like, if she wanted to see her baby. She was saying that she felt guilty and didn't understand why she never said anything to her about. Mm-hmm. Offered.
Yes.
But she never said anything about Clarence.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, she also has some harsh words for Sandra,
mm-hmm.
Which, yeah.
Sandra doesn't come off great in this documentary, and it's just one of those cliched tropes that I would like to stop seeing of the good mom, bad mom dichotomy, you know? The adoptive, Megan's adoptive mom, good mom. Heather's mom, good mom. And we even have Suzanne is described as like the perfect mother, essentially.
Yeah, to Michael.
Michael. And it's almost as if they had to like villainize one person in order to say this would have never happened if you had been a better mother. When the reason she ended up in that church in the first place was because she went to social services and they were like, honey, go to church. We'll take your kids, but go to church. That I'm pretty sure illegal. Advice that was given to her. And so she went to church and then she was
preyed upon
by a pedophile who stole her children.
Yeah.
What? Like, exactly. How are we making this woman? It's just, I'm not a mom. I've been a caretaker of kids. It's not easy to be a mother.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not. And you don't know what circumstances people have come from or are going through. And to just, I just hate this whole good mom, bad mom dichotomy that is set up so much in the world, because it doesn't make any sense. Like, you're supposed to be some supernatural almost force who has endless time to give to your children or child, and also be able to care for them. So, like, if you're alone, you've got to have a career, I guess. And so you're going to be expected to be perfect there, too. But if you're working, does that make you a bad mom? It just doesn't. It sets up all of these different paradoxes that are impossible for women to live up to, or people who are caretakers or children to live up to. And we get that good mom, good parent, bad parent dichotomy. And I just don't like it.
I was very surprised at the focus, or the emphasis, let's say, that people put on Michael adored his mother. Now, I'm not a mother, but in my experience of two-year-old children,
they have no choice.
They adore their mother. It's part of the biological imperative, you know, so that they continue to live and thrive. I mean, it's not to say that Suzanne wasn't a good mother, but it was such a strange point to make. Make the point that she adored him, yes, because that's not a given. But it is pretty much a given that a two-year-old is going to adore their mother. But not a mother. This is the other thing, too. To your point, LaTanya, everybody has an opinion about mothers.
Everyone does. Yeah. And opinions are like a-holes. But, you know, it was something that stood out to me. You know, some of the big things that stood out to me were obviously all of the institutional failure that happened that we've been touching on at different parts of this discussion. The, you know, good mom, bad mom kind of dichotomy that happens. And then just the peril of having people like Floyd exist and walk among us. This story is probably far too common. And there are just lots of instances that we don't learn about. And one of the reasons that, you know, other than the fact that Suzanne was ultimately murdered, one of the things that kind of, you know, made people like us, or like, you know, maybe like a little further than us, who are actually like internet sleuths, like really care, was the whole title, The Girl in the Picture. You have this incredibly sad looking white blonde girl. And of course, and it seems to be, with the exception of these three women in her life, these mostly men wanted, like, you know, live their entire career to be able to figure out what happened to this girl, to be able to rescue or figure out if they can give some type of cosmic justice for this girl. And, you know, it's stories like that that get picked out and get the documentary treatment, when there are tons of other stories that I'm sure are very similar that happen with Black and brown people every day. There's an Amber Alert in Chicago constantly, you know, but it doesn't get this type of coverage because the value of the life isn't the same in accordance to some people. So I just thought that those three things kind of looming over what was already a very much mystery box of a documentary made it a lot more weighty, especially on a first watch, than some of the others I've seen in the past.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes.
ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
When they do catch Floyd after him like running around, he no longer has Michael, of course. They don't know what happened to Michael. They assume Michael's dead. And they don't actually ever say, like, did he actually kill Suzanne? From what I understand, did I miss that part in the documentary? They could not say without a shadow of a doubt that he was the one who led to her, that hit and run and her dying, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's the assumption, yeah. Because she had the marks of a physical fight on her, and the doctor says an extraordinary thing, which was, you know, for a person involved with a vehicle, she was in quite good shape. So they feel that there were other... They feel that he murdered her. He's never confessed it, and it's never been proven. So the idea of getting justice for her, I mean, we are introduced late in the piece to Matt Birkbeck, who's an author. He wrote two books about her. One is called A Beautiful Child, and one's called Finding Sharon, because by the end of A Beautiful Child, they didn't know who she was. And to your point, LaTanya, I hate it when they say, so beautiful. Like, you know,
it's a weird title for your book.
Yeah.
It's a weird title for your book.
Yeah.
Another title.
Especially knowing what happened to her for like 15 years.
Yeah. And honestly, I guess it ended up leading to good things, but I questioned the motives of this author, Matt, for going and doing all of these interviews and learning literally nothing about Suzanne in any of the interviews. Just, you know, and that was what his stated goal was. He never got the answers that he was seeking. He didn't find out her name. He didn't find out where she was from. He didn't find out whether or not she was murdered by Floyd. He just let a sociopath with dangerous psychotic tendencies talk about himself, which they love to do for pages and pages of a book. And it wasn't until other people and tips started to come in that the book started to get a little like more notoriety that this led to eventually finding out who Suzanne actually was. But, you know, if your goal when you go to try to make a book is to help, you know, I discover a mystery of what happened to a horribly abused person that you call a beautiful child on your cover, and then you have basically nothing about them in your book because you just gave in to the you just talked to the like essentially the glorified the abuser and the person who most likely murdered her.
Yes, he sees nothing wrong in saying, you know, I saw the photograph and I was, he doesn't say bewitched, but I mean, I mean, he's an investigative journalist. I'm sure he's an upstanding member of the community, but it was a very strange interview, and it's a strange that he put two books out of it. And he went, as you say, to see Floyd, and essentially Floyd talked on and on. Now, this wasn't highlighted, and it's, we do not want to make any, let me make this perfectly clear. No apologies, no excuses, because other people have this happen to them and don't turn out to be pedophilic, sex abuse murderers. But Floyd was in group homes. He was small. He was raped. He was beaten himself. Full stop. That happens to other people and they don't turn into abusers.
Everyone in his family, all of the children in his family were sent to homes.
Yes.
And we're not watching a documentary about any of them.
Exactly. We got the information from these tapes that Matt Birkbeck made in jail with Floyd. They're quite hard to hear, but he talks about it. But it's just this lines running along the bottom of the screen and nothing more. It says that you either make something of it or you don't tell it. It was just so strange to dot in this information and then move past it. And that really struck me on the second watch. What do you think, Murray?
I honestly did. Like, I cannot tell you what was said, to be quite honest, because I'm the type that I don't like hearing the serial killers' confessions and stuff like that, mostly because it's like, it feels like a lot of like stroking and stuff like that. Like, I do not like it. And especially like Floyd stuff, it seemed incoherent to me. It seemed like he wasn't really trying to give them any answers. So the fact that he eventually did give them answers, and that is how they were able to figure out Suzanne's real name. And then he finally told them in 2015 that he had killed Michael, but we still don't have Michael's body or anything like that, was kind of anticlimactic to me, to be quite honest. I thought this whole documentary, we were introduced to so many people who were working on the case, and for it to come down to like, they really hit a brick wall. And it took the book, finding Megan's daughter, and then finally, just for the last time, just going and talking to Floyd to get her name was very kind of anticlimactic.
That makes total sense, Mari. I think the filmmakers, I think, were going for a Dear Zachary here in terms of Michael. I don't know if you all have seen this documentary.
I am not. It's okay. On my list. So
I'm not going to ruin it for anyone, but I'll just say, I think that's what they were going for. And I don't think that it landed nearly as well as the documentary that you should watch called Dear Zachary.
Okay.
That's like coy as I can be.
Anything else before we get to our magnifying glasses?
No. I do, my only thing is this. I want to say, like, it sounds like we're picking the documentary apart because we are. But all that to say, I did enjoy the documentary, and I completely understand again why we got so many recommendations to watch it. Like, I truly did really like it.
Well, do you want to start with your rating of magnifying glasses, Mari? We usually ask the guests first, but you've already started.
Oh, shoot. Okay. No problem. No worries. I'll give it a 3.5. Like, I will. Again, we've watched so many things that, like I've said on previous podcasts, that actually were better the second time around, that I do have to dock it for not being as enjoyable the second time around. However, that is not, you know, normally people don't watch documentaries like that. They don't normally watch them back to back in order to break them down and assess them on a podcast. So I did really like it. And the only thing that takes it down even further, a little bit of a notch, is like Sarah said, I would get very confused easily where we were in the timeline. Because I was like, oh, now it's 95 and they found Cheryl's body. Like, it was... And now we're in 2015. Like, that was kind of, not having the title cards up there long enough did really confuse me. Like I said, when we were watching it together, me and my husband were watching it, I was like, are we not in 1994? He's like, no, I think we're in 2002 right now. And I'm like, you know, so that's where I'll dock it. So 3.5, really good. Definitely recommend.
And LaTanya, what about you?
So it's a 5-point scale to half tenths.
Yeah, we don't care. Don't say 4.1.
Yeah, that's why I was asking if it was half tenths. That's how we give speaker points in debate.
That's funny.
So, yeah, I like, as a speaker point in debate person, I would give it a 3.75. Probably. Oh, but I think it's only to half tenths. So I would agree, I think, with 3.5, maybe 4, just because of anticipatory nature of this documentary for me. I'd seen this picture, because they're so right. That picture of Floyd with Suzanne as a young child is so many places on the internet. Yeah. If you're into true crime, inevitably you're going to watch something about it. But whatever I watched, I guess I completely forgot, because everything seemed like a huge surprise to me when I first saw this documentary. I would say that just for a couple things, plenty of documentaries editorialize. That's not what's supposed to happen. It's supposed to be objective filmmaking, but plenty of documentaries are done for editorial purposes. I believe that this one could have been, I think it was, but I think it could have been more effective if they'd done the things that we talked about with the title cards, given us some type of timeline, and not chosen to not highlight institutional failure that happened. to not kind of tell the story of Sandra, Suzanne's biological mom, differently. And then, you know, to just have this be such a mystery box of a documentary that I think it took away a little bit from all in all what it could have accomplished. I really like the documentary. I think mm-hmm. we're just being, you know, like you nitpick things because you
like them.
Like them and you want and you to want try to understand them more mm-hmm. and you want them to be better. So, I like this documentary. I hope people don't walk away from hearing this podcast thinking that that's not the case.
Well, we hope they've already seen it by now. Otherwise, yeah. we've given everything away. Look, I recommend this documentary. Yes, watch it. Or if you've already watched it, congratulations. Well done. Mm. I'm going to give it 3. Now, we've said before that 3 is good. So yeah. when you hear me say 3, it's not saying it's bad. I think it's worth watching. I give it a 3. I think the story itself is absolutely, it's a 5 out of 5 story. It's an extraordinary story. But I think that there are failings within the documentary that as a reviewer, as a viewer, great. As a reviewer and doing this podcast, I have to dock it for some of the things. First of all, Latanya, I completely agree. The institutional failure, for my taste, I would have liked that highlighted. I would have liked a more acerbic look at the many people who allowed this to happen, not only the people that feel guilty, like the friends and the other dancers, but the people who feel no guilt at all, who are the ones they're supposed to be looking after. So there's that. I probably would have been 3.5 had it not been for the final section, which we haven't discussed, which is the laying and the revelation of the new tombstone. It's very affecting because it has her name, her face, and her dates, as we said. But this last section is so long compared to the length of the whole documentary. And the shift in tone to a sentimentality I found very, particularly on the second watch. There was this gear change into sentiment, and it hadn't been sentimental up till then. It had been factual. We'd met really interesting people. They'd told their stories honestly and with emotion or with their intellect or however they'd told their stories. And then we get to this very sentimental, long sentimental section with the unveiling of the tombstone. And for me, that really is a big dock because that's the last thing that I see. Having said all that, recommend, go and watch it, but it's definitely not the best thing that we've seen during our 18 episodes, Murray.
So quick question. So you're saying you don't like the sentimental tone it ends on?
I do not, no.
Hmm.
No.
Why is that, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah.
It's a tone thing for me because I suppose part of it is the time spent on the tombstone. The tombstone is a fact, one fact. And that Cliff got to meet his granddaughter, Megan, who then has a child. That's also a fact. But we spent so much time with people being really happy that she finally had a tombstone, really happy that I can now go and visit her there, really happy that there is, you know, an end to Suzanne's story. I just thought tonally it didn't fit for me, and I'm also not very sentimental, so perhaps I'm being a bit mean. But I'm going to stick by it.
No, that makes sense. Especially since you feel like it's really interesting because she's the main victim that we focus on, but it's like Michael dies and it's just like, what happened to Michael? Cheryl died. They don't really care about what happened to Cheryl. Like, I get it. It was a very, very weird tone shift.
I mean, if you don't notice it, you don't notice it, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. I just, I felt like the documentary had dealt with a very, very dark, very troubling, very disturbing story, which unfortunately is not a unique story. Mm-hmm. And then it was trying to say, but it's all okay because here's Megan and she's had a baby and she never met her brother Michael, but she's named her baby Michael. And now Cliff gets to meet his granddaughter. And it was like, this is not the story. I mean, it's the facts, but it's not the story, as far as I was concerned.
That makes sense.
But that's just me.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense, especially like the meeting of the grandchild, the emphasis on passing on the name when, again, sacrificing substance for style. The things that they could have gone into more, which is why I said 3.5 instead of 4, that they could have gone into more, are the other people who also died. We get way more of Michael than we get of Cheryl. Cheryl's story is basically non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that he's actually been sentenced for.
Right. Exactly.
You know, we don't
given the death sentence for.
Right. We don't talk to any of Cheryl's relatives or people who know her other than Heather. So we only see one side of her in this documentary. Mm. And we don't see that for very long. And it's in the way that it's that story has begun to be told seems like an interruption of the high school days of Suzanne. So that makes total sense. And I guess most people, especially people on Netflix watching true crime, need some schmaltz at the end of their documentary when the subject matter has been that dark.
I will give you that. I will give you that. I mean, I know why it's there. It's there to say, but here is the happy thing,
right.
And here's Megan, and she's angry, but she'll get over it, she tells us. And I thought,
will you though?
It's not interesting.
Like,
and it's also not interesting to me.
There's nothing about this documentary to me that feels truly resolved either.
Yeah.
We've learned Suzanne's name.
Yep.
And we use it throughout this podcast because for so much of her life, she wasn't able to be called her name. We learn Suzanne's name, but she gets no justice at all. The idea that they couldn't circumstantially tie a case together in the South to prove that this convicted murderer also murdered his wife, who also murdered his quote unquote son, is ridiculous. Like, it's just not, everything that happens institutionally in this documentary seems like such a far step away from every way that the South normally happens. I mean, the Florida-Georgia line is where this crime allegedly occurred, and you're telling me that neither one of those states wants to give this guy the needle?
Well,
I'm not
technically
saying it should happen. I'm just saying that I'm not advocating the death penalty. I'm just saying that these people don't get any justice.
Well, he did. He did get the death penalty in Florida for Cheryl.
For Cheryl, I know.
Yeah, for Cheryl, yeah.
But I'm just saying that's just for Cheryl.
That's
for Michael
for Cheryl,
and Suzanne, all we learn really is Suzanne's name.
Yeah, and again, that might be where the deficit comes from because, like I said, for Suzanne's hit and run, they really didn't. They told us about the extent of her injuries that the hospital saw and that they thought it was like repeated abuse. But then when she died, it's still like the only thing that we get is that flippant line by the FBI guy. I think at one point where they're like, we really had nothing. No, I don't think it was the FBI guy. I'm sorry. It was the attorney. I think when they caught him after, he ran away with Michael. They said that all they could get him on was the kidnapping of Michael, the kidnapping of the principal, kidnapping with like the wedding,
weapon.
Sorry. So they stacked the charges on him for the things that they could, but they couldn't get him on Suzanne. They didn't have. They still to this day don't have Michael's body. So that I like I said previously, that's where it feels like it's lacking. Like the end of the story. It's almost like this is still a cold case in a sense, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is why I find the tonal shift so wrong, because you disturb us with this story, leave us disturbed with our thoughts. Although, Latonya, I absolutely take your point that there's a feeling like we can't leave our general audience, you know, in a disturbed and upset way, so we're going to give them this kind of picture of the new generation and the new Michael and all of that, but I thought it was disrespectful, too strong a word, but it was as if there was a forced bow being put on what is really a very sad and very melancholy when I think about where Michael is. I mean, he's somewhere. And it's very melancholy to think of that poor little boy kind of alone in the earth somewhere. But then I have a darker taste, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to our recommendations. Latanya, do you have anything to recommend to our listeners, a book, a podcast, a film?
So I talked a little bit about Dear, as much as I can talk about Dear Zachary, because that really is a documentary that if you know anything going in, then it's ruined. It's not even ruined. It's ruined. I've been watching on HBO Max. I've been watching Mind Over Murder, which is a documentary about the rape and murder of an elderly woman in Beatrice, a very small town. And now they're trying to figure out exactly what happened. And the local town production, local town community theater is going to do a play where they reenact a lot of the police conversations that happened and courtroom footage and stuff like that. So that's an interesting way into a documentary for me. I've been watching D.B. Cooper, Where Are You? On Netflix. Mm-hmm. That just, I think, came out yesterday. And yeah, I hadn't really put together a list. But if you like true crime and you also enjoy learning as much as you can about the Mormons, this isn't a documentary, but I just find the Mormon religion to be so fascinating that, you know, we've had the Keep Sweet and Obey. That's like one of the things that people talk about right now. There's a couple other Mormon related documentaries on Netflix you want to look at. But if you haven't watched Under the Banner of Heaven, which is a Hulu series with
Andrew Garfield.
There we go. That's the one. Who is just having like a great year in terms of acting. And he's playing a detective who is trying to solve a murder in Utah, a very small town in Utah, with his native Paiute partner, who is not a Mormon. And it's just very interesting look inside the religion, inside of some of the ways that fundamentalism changes the religion, introducing those ideas changes it. And, you know, it's a murder mystery story that you don't find out who the murderers are until the very end. So might enjoy that.
Oh, wonderful. We'll put all those in the show notes. Mari, do you have anything to recommend today?
I do. It's a little bit different. I'm going to recommend the YouTube channel, Mr. Ballin on YouTube. It's this guy, John, I think his name is John Allen. And he talks about if you were enamored by seeing the picture, like the girl in the picture and then hearing the backstory, he has a whole like a playlist genre of like creepy photos where he shows the photo and he gives the creepy background story behind it. He also does like three places that people can't go that people went anyways, which is a really interesting series. It is like a lot of death and murder style storytelling. His tagline is like, if you like dark, scary stories told in a narrative form, this is what he does on his channel. So it's and he also has a podcast, the Mr. Ballin podcast. That's Mr. Ballen podcast. I was just Googling him to make sure like I didn't see any other controversies about him. He's a former Marine, Navy SEAL, who talks about his time in the military. I checked. If he becomes a milkshake duck down the line, that's not my fault.
We will re-edit the podcast as if we had never mentioned him. Right. Thanks, Murray. That's great. Mm-hmm. I'm going to recommend an incredible podcast series, which I just can't recommend it highly enough. It's called Bird's Eye View from Story Projects. There's a couple of podcast series called Bird's Eye View. This is the one from Story Projects. It's a 10-part series. It was a 2-year project made with women incarcerated in Darwin Correctional in the Northern Territory. This is a men's prison, predominantly men's prison, and there's a small number of women in it. It's one of the best things I've heard in a long time. 18 of the women at Darwin Correctional made the podcast, And you can hear our interview with one of those women, Rocket, on Inside Job, nice. Drive-by plug. At Crime Scene, we're eager to hear your feedback and suggestions for further episodes. You can follow Crime Scene on Twitter at Crime Scene RHAP, that's S-E-E-N, or email us at crimescene@gmail.com. LaTonya, what have you got going on? Where can the people find you?
You can find me on Twitter.com at LK Starks, LK Starks. And I, let's see, what do I have coming up that I can talk about?
Oh, mysterious.
I will be on the Blackbird podcast with Grace Leader and the other Ariel. We'll be discussing that Apple TV Plus show. It's about a young man who has to go into a maximum security mental ward prison in order to find out the location of a young woman's body from a serial killer. And if he does that, then he gets time off, he gets, you know, time served and gets to get out for the crime that he committed. So it's really interesting and intense so far. I think as of today, there are 3 episodes out. So I'll be talking about that show. I will at some point, rehab-wise, have a follow-up interview for Top Chef with Chef Nick Wallace, who is one of the standouts and finalists of the show. We haven't scheduled that yet, but I know that's something that I could at least plug. And I think those are the 2 things I have going on for now. Oh, I'll be in the latest Renap. As this podcast comes out, you all will be able to listen to me on the most recent Renap, which I'll record tomorrow.
Wonderful. Mari, what about you? Where can people follow you?
You can follow me on Twitter at Mari Talks Too Much. That's 2 like the number 2. And of course, you can catch me every week with the wonderful Matt Scott on the Wrestling Rehab Up podcast, where we recap the highlights of the week in wrestling. And so go to robhasawebsite.com/wrestlingfeed in order to subscribe to us there. You can also catch me recapping and doing live feed updates for the current Big Brother season, Big Brother 24. I was just recently on the live feed update, and I will be on an episode recap this week. So if you want to listen to my Big Brother coverage and you want to know when I will be appearing, just go and follow me on Twitter, because I'll post whenever that happens. So again, follow me on Twitter at Mari Talks Too Much Too. Like the number 2. Sarah, what about you?
Well, you can follow me, if you like, on Twitter at Sarah Carradine. Recently, the amazing Matt Scott invited me onto the Pod Friends podcast. So if you want to hear me banging on about rubbish, go and have a listen there. That's also on RHAP. So next time on Crime Scene, we are covering Gladbeck, which is a German language hostage-taking documentary. You can do subs or dubs. We don't dub shame here at Crime Scene. And Matt Scott's getting another shout-out. He will be our guest. So watch it on Netflix and send us your comments and questions.
Thank you, LaTonya, for joining us. Thanks to Will from America for our theme music, Tricky Writes for the graphics, and Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. Until next time.
Case closed.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer. computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.